Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben, and joining me once again is my co-host, Anna, who needs no introduction.
Never. Thanks, Ben.
It's exceptionally good to see you.
Oh, likewise.
And we're talking across the continent today on the 50th anniversary of the original theatrical release of They Might Be Giants, the June 9th, 1971 semi-comedy film about mental health and Sherlock Holmes, directed by Anthony Harvey, starring George C. Scott and Joni Woodward. At the time it came out, Vincent Canby in the New York Times said that it was mushy with occasional isolated moments of legitimate comedy, which is damning with very specifically narrow praise. But Stephen Cantor of Time magazine said that if A.A. Milne had written They Might Be Giants, he would have destroyed it, that it had a dismal end for a conceit that must have seemed promising at birth, but by the time he got to the end of the movie, he wished it rather hadn't have existed. This is generally considered to be a cult film, in part because after its theatrical release, all home video releases were missing key scenes until the eventual Blu-ray release or home theater release on DVD. So the actual ending of the film was missing for a significantly long time. And people's responses to it were very strange. The director is hideously conflicted about it. It's a fascinating piece whose legacy might just be inspiring the pop band from the 1990s out of Lincoln, Massachusetts, more than anything else. Anna, what did you think about They Might Be Giants?
I definitely thought it was a thinker, like despite being a true caper, I definitely had a lot to reflect on, like during and at the end. Mm. Although I agree that it's definitely overshadowed by the musical band, at least for the SEO presence.
Yeah. You have to definitely put in other search terms in order to narrow it down to finding stuff about the 71 existence. Even more difficult to find is anything about the original theatrical run in Stratford and Avon a decade earlier.
The play.
1961, the play.
Yeah, absolutely. I could find nothing. So I'm excited to hear what you uncovered.
Well, I decided to not pay for a subscription to britishnewspapers.co.uk in order to read some reviews because I wasn't sure how much additional insight I'd get out of reading the terrible reviews that almost drove the director, Littlewood, into retirement. Like, she was so devastated by the bad notices from this play that she almost quit directing for a number of years and was just savaged. There was one article I was able to read a small excerpt from that talked about the fact that she'd wished she'd had more time to develop it, and that, you know, when you're writing and working on a play, especially for the first time, you rarely consider it to be a gospel text that you're bringing to the stage. There's a lot you can do to alter it, change it, fluff it, and find its voice. There's very rarely a sense that this is the finished text to which we must cleave.
Can I just clarify? So the original, the play, was, it's from the UK? Is that what you're saying?
James Goldman, the writer, is a New Yorker. But it was never mounted as a theatrical production in the United States, to anyone's knowledge. The writer Goldman was in France, I believe, where they were finishing up the filming of director Anthony Harvey's previous picture starring Peter O'Toole and Katharine Hepburn, A Lion in Winter. And Harvey said, what else do you have? What else are you working on? And he mentioned this play that had been such a disaster and said, But Harvey liked the sound of it and decided to develop it into a feature. spent a year and a half on pre-production, worked very hard to get it into shape, worked with Goldman to turn it from a script into a screenplay, which are very different monsters, and has an interview in a newspaper in 1970 where he says that he usually hates when he sees a rough cut of a movie. He says he's always miserable when he sees the edit in progress. But he says, I'm very pleased with this one. And so subsequently, for the film to be an albatross around his neck, where he complained deeply about the fact that the film was edited by the studio, totally changed after the fact. He said the studio caused the edits to, quote, lose the excitement and the madness, and that they never really understood the script that they had paid $400,000 for. And so it was released as a jaunty, off-kilter, middle-aged romance, but that's not what he had intended it to be.
What had he intended it to be?
Well, the essential theme is all wrapped up in Don Quixote. The title itself, They Might Be Giants, is an idea that if you are somebody staring at windmills, they might be windmills, but if you're Don Quixote, they might be giants. They might be monsters that need to be slain.
He thought that every windmill was a giant. That's insane. But thinking that they might be, all the best minds used to think the world was flat. What if it isn't?
And the opening quotation, which is attributed to Dr. Watson, but is nowhere in Arthur Conan Doyle, is probably, therefore, the Dr. Watson of this movie and no other Dr. Watson, mentions the idea that Quixote had his windmills. There's an enormous amount of Quixote threads throughout the film. I think it was supposed to be amusing on what is the purpose of madness. Is it something that allows us to see beyond a veil into a secret truth, or is it something that we use to protect ourselves against greater harm? The whole pastiche of the movie, as you know, Anna, but as our audience might not, is that George C. Scott plays a lawyer who has gone completely bug nuts and who believes that he's Sherlock Holmes, although he's aware of the fact that everybody else thinks that he's not Sherlock Holmes, and in a position where he has to answer to the name of this person that he used to be, whose name, I believe, is Daniel Playfair.
Oh, why does everyone call
him
Justin?
A very obvious name if you're talking about themes of injustice and random violence.
It's a little on the nose, but okay.
It's a lot on the nose. But he's aware that other people think he's crazy and talks about their perceptions of that craziness a couple of different times with a haunted quality. So I think that there may have been a different cut of the movie where it was less, where it alternated back and forth between the more jovial aspects, the more manic aspects of crazy, the more creative aspects of his insanity, and the more haunted aspects, and that's what it was about, and less so a woman who falls in love with an insane man so much that she's willing to believe in his madness.
Are those really the options that we have?
I'm up for more.
Yeah, I just want to maybe note that some of the language that we're using is very sensitive.
Please tell me more.
You know, it's interesting. I think that the part of the movie and what the movie is about is exploring this idea of, like, what is an altered mental state?
Okay.
And like, who gets to say? But I think that really what I was responding to is just that the word crazy can be, like, really harsh as a label. And it cannot feel good. So just to sort of, like, make a note of that up front, like, as we carry through our podcast, that, like, I think the language that we use is going to be sort of, like, lighthearted as we, like, talk about this movie, which is fictional, but the language can be very hurtful to a lot of people who are closely affected by these topics. that makes sense.
So you're saying that while I'm potentially reflecting either my own ignorance or the terms that the film establishes in 1971, that talking about mental illness would have been a more receptive or less aggressive way of talking about these things?
You know, it's funny. I think I...
Because I definitely don't think I have the language for this.
No, it's okay. And I think that that's a good reason to, like, not get too hung up on it, but just to sort of make a note that we are going to use language that is potentially challenging for
people. Not sensitive.
Yeah. I think that even mental illness has its drawbacks. And I think that the more important thing is, to me, to just make a note of it, you know, that... we understand that this is, like, hard for some people and that, like, that's not really what we're here to do. You know, that we're talking about a movie that raises these issues and is imperfect in them. And we're going to toss some words around that we recognize are imperfect. And I think that when I engage with language, there's no getting it right all of the time. And a lot of that has to do with the culture. You know, like, if the culture is not healthy, like, if the culture has a lot of taboo and shame and stigma around certain kinds of behaviors or health statuses, then the language is never going to overcome that or not reflect that eventually. I think George Carlin said this. This is not my idea, right? I don't want to plagiarize, but just to reflect that the perfect language is a moving target and we will never get it right, but to acknowledge that we are conscientious of the way that people are affected by these words.
I'm going to say probably you more than me. So I hope that you are perfectly willing to red flag me if I walk into certain things. And the film, certainly even less than I am, when we are introduced to the main character of Dr. Mildred Watson, her surname being hidden for some time, mm-hmm. she is absolutely gleeful in the idea that when she, I think I called him David Playfair earlier before, it's Justin Playfair.
Even more on the nose.
Correct. When she's introduced to him, she's so excited that she finds him to be...
classic paranoid. Fantastic.
And that's her main instant initial professional glee. Mm-hmm. Is that she gets to deal with a person who is so surrounded by his delusions that he is a almost stereotypical, and here's where the language gets harsh again, funny farm occupant, the sort of person that you do see in cartoons and sketches about insanity of people who believe that they're Napoleon or that sort of thing. The idea that somebody would have convinced themselves out of trauma that they are Sherlock Holmes is investigated a little bit, but is mostly played for laughs. And the first interaction that we get also, well, the second interaction we get with Justin Holmes' character is him diagnosing that another character in the film, another patient at the mental hospital, is somebody who believes that he is the silent film star and star of The Shake.
My God!
Rudolph Valentino.
Sherlock Holmes.
Honor, sir.
So that she was actually working with another classic paranoid right in front of her. It's just that she didn't know that because he was not speaking at the time.
What did you think about that?
What aspect of it?
It's interesting to me that you said that you felt like the Sherlock thing was played mostly for laughs, because I felt like, you know, they have, like, the head doctor of the hospital, and they have her at the beginning. And what I perceived in the arc of the movie is that they're setting up this condescending clinical tone of authority.
The doctor at the sanitarium especially so.
Exactly, yeah. And then they tear it down, and they mm-hmm. sort of, like, role reverse and investigate whose mental state gets to have authority. And that happens very early on, you know, where the Sherlock character, you know, that comes in, and he has a lot of authority because he is very smart and he has worked very hard to be the person that he is, regardless of who he is expressing himself to be, you know, whether it's the Sherlock character or whether it's, like, Justin, who everyone, I guess, like, wants him to be.
Who's rich and a lawyer and has had authoritative life before this.
Yeah. And so I'm wondering, how did you see this scene when Watson is with her other patient? Like, how did that go for you?
Whose actual name is Mr. Mills or something Mr. Small. Mr. Small, yeah. Who's this young man with big glasses and wild hair, slightly rotund, and yet who, against all physical evidence, believes that he's the most sexy man of the silent film era, Rudolph Valentino.
Oh, I didn't get the reference. That's really funny. I found that character, that actor, to be so charming. Like, he was this total scene stealer to me. Yeah, I don't know.
Very charismatic, very fun.
Like, expressed so much without talking. And yeah, we were on his side the whole time.
But it is a joke that while he is charismatic, while he's very likable and pitiable, he does not resemble the bare-chested Swami of the silent film era at all.
Yeah, I missed that one.
And so there is a degree of, I think this is answering your question, please tell me if I'm not, that Playfair's Holmes treats him with utter conviction and respect, believes in his belief. Once he deduces who he is 100% saying, I'm so pleased to meet you. This is wonderful. And similarly, Mr. Small's Valentino says, I'm a huge fan of all your books. Like, there's an instant grasp of the fictions that surpasses the other things. It's difficult to read the line where Holmes says to Dr. Watson,
tell him how much you liked him in the Sheik.
This is ridiculous.
You didn't like me.
Oh, no, no, you were very good.
Is he saying, play along with his fiction, Doctor? That's what will keep him docile. Or is he saying, he's a great performer, give him his due? The line isn't necessarily read in one direction or another. I think that would be therefore very up to interpretation as, is the figure supposed to be, I'm already going on too long about this, I apologize. Is the figure supposed to be a thing that we start off thinking that it's a joke and then we realize it's actually more interesting than that because Holmes's reaction is to treat him fair.
I wish we had you on the staff here.
You could use me.
Or is it just a multi-layered joke that even Holmes is in on some level? I legitimately don't think I have a close read on that.
Well, what we know about Holmes's character is, he acts with integrity, right? He's, this lawful good. You know, I would never expect him to...
Excellent. Bring it into D&D meme territory. I'm here for that.
Of our audience? Okay, so...
It should be.
Yeah. I would say that we really see him acting so consistently. I think that communicates, this core impulse of respect for others as they are asking to be treated. For Justin, he's like, treat me like Sherlock. Like, that's what I need right now. This guy is telling you who he is. Just talk to him. Like, he's asking you to talk to him.
One of the major arcs over the course of the film is that they accrue a gang of weirdos.
Yeah.
And I alluded to earlier the fact that for most of the post-cinema life of this movie, there was an entire scene missing, which is that all of the people they meet over the course of the movie show up in a supermarket and attack the cops that are trying to get Justin and Mildred to capture them. And in a war of throwing foodstuffs and frozen cans and various things at them, are momentarily victorious and then overwhelmed, and then Holmes gets on the PA and tricks the crass commercialism of the police officers into revealing their own terrible insanity, that they're more interested in the deals going on in the supermarket than they are in arresting all these crazy people, and everyone's able to escape.
The chance of a lifetime, tonight only, prime ribs, 10 cents a pound.
I can't let that go by. My wife would kill me.
That scene wasn't on home video for 30 years, which means that it would have cut from after the giant march with the amazing theme music. They would have gotten to the top of the tunnel, gone down in, looked back, and realized that nobody followed them in. And it would have cut to them in the park staring down the dark tunnel and expecting Moriarty on horseback to come through without any leavened victory, without any support from the other people that they'd found along the way. They would have just accumulated people to be abandoned by them.
Mm.
That's what most people saw when they saw this movie on video for a really long time. What we saw and what the original theatrical experience was, is that over the course of this film, he meets all these people and he treats them, as you say, as they want to be treated, with respect and with a belief that whatever their thing is valuable. The people that have been living off their own plants for 70 years. The woman in the telephone operator is the person I'm most thinking of, where Holmes is trying to get her to help a woman who is trying to help a man who is suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
And he misjudges her. He thinks that she's just a puppet of the system.
This is unendurable. You there. Give me the unlisted list.
Send a guard to the information room.
Well, you there. At once.
And she's locked in procedure, and then he realizes she wants to help, but feels trapped in the system around her.
Mm-hmm.
He misjudges her, but instantly forgives her, instantly is able to empathically connect and realize that she's just as hurt as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of feeling realization is not something that an audience associates with the clinical, cerebral Sherlock Holmes. I think that's one of the more interesting takes in this film.
Because it breaks out of that traditional Sherlock Holmes and incorporates this other aspect of empathy and engagement mm-hmm. and relationship.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the very fact that perhaps against director Harvey's wishes, the film became a middle-aged romance. I mean, it's very specific in the books that Holmes is not interested in relationships at all.
Mm-hmm.
He has his friendship with Watson, which is important above all, and has caused its own series of interpretations about homosexuality, of the idea that Holmes was a woman in disguise and therefore could never reveal her love for Watson, who was married, like all these different interpretations, just in order to say, we don't believe that men can have a friendship that's deep and passionate and almost classically Greek without it having to be a romantic one.
Hmm.
All that aside, this film is instantly about the connection between these two people and the almost bottomless trust they have for each other very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of an emotional intelligence is very rarely part of Conan Doyle's Holmes.
Did you feel like the romantic connection was believable? It sounds like you did.
I didn't interrogate it.
Yeah.
I think to have done so would have revealed flaws.
Fair enough.
So, for example, one of the major things that happens over the course of the film, we mentioned that they run into these two botanists that are in a school that they decode through finding garbage on the street and locate in the kind of bizarre lucky free association that is the, quote, deduction that Playfair's Holmes does over the course of the film.
Midnight. We meet tomorrow midnight.
It's not Moriarty who's striking his Columbia.
Well, he had to get the message to me somehow. Now, the clue that leads us to the place, he put it somewhere obvious, but unexpected.
So annoying. It never got less annoying.
They wander into this situation where they encounter this obscure couple, and right before they go in, Watson says, if we get split up, let's meet back at my apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene doesn't have an ending, by the way. Like, they each make it out of the building on their own. It's a terrible fight scene, awful fight choreography. And then it just cuts to Watson in her apartment trying to make dinner. It's a date. Like, it's gone from, if we get separated, let's meet back to, I need to get ready for my big date with Justin. That transition from, I'm your doctor, I'm supposed to be diagnosing you, to, I don't understand you, but I trust you because I'm seeing you do stuff that doesn't make sense, but which is generous and open and interesting, to, oh my God, oh my God, if I don't get this thawed, it won't cook, and then I won't be able to get dressed in time, and I don't have a vase to put the flowers in. Like, that transition is goofy and unearned, and so I mostly didn't look at it.
Yeah. Part of what I really loved about this movie is that I feel like this is one of our earliest examples of the manic pixie dream girl.
I didn't look up Joni Woodward's age in this, but can you have a 42-year-old manic pixie dream girl?
Oh, no. Sherlock Holmes is the manic pixie dream girl.
Oh, tell me more.
Well, think about it. So she's the, like, lonely, rigid, codependent therapist who has, like, this unethical lapse, right? She's, like, locked into her single professional lifestyle, and she needs, like, a romantic awakening provided by this quirky character who shows up to take her on a journey of self-discovery.
And shows her that there's more than just her book learning, but there's this marvelous, unexpected way of interacting with what is real and what isn't, and opens up her eyes and perspective on what the world is really like.
Yeah. It's a classic cinematic trope. It's just that the genders are reversed.
Holmes doesn't put headphones on her and say, hey, listen to the Shins, but you're not wrong.
No, instead he, like, negs her with... like a 30-second monologue about facts about her life that he couldn't have known.
You suffer from insomnia and sometimes drink yourself to sleep. You think you're homely and you're glad you're growing old. You bite your nails. You're frightened you're a failure, but you're lost without your work. I've got more. Do you want it?
By all means.
And she's like, wow, maybe I can love again.
Oh, that is harsh, but fair. That you're basically right, is that he does what negging is intended to do, which is he breaks her down so that she becomes dependent on his superior insight into her and therefore the world. Oh.
You are very fluent with the definition of negging a lot of people. I have to explain it a lot to people. It's a thing. Huh. But
I don't want to say I'm naturally fluent in the skill, but I think I am the sort of person who leads with criticism.
I'm
not intending to break people down. I worry I fall into accidental negging.
It was about like 20, 25 minutes into the movie, and I was like, oh, it's a movie about Ben and me.
Oof.
I revised it, don't worry.
Okay, good. Because, yeah, being the slightly older, weird, cerebral, insane guy is a little too close to home.
Yeah, super cerebral, kind of mean, runs intellectual circles around people.
Ouch. Okay, Sherlock, who's deconstructing whom now?
Getting too personal. Okay, back to the movie.
Nope. It's just fine. If I can't take it, I don't deserve to be.
Well, it's not that I didn't find their romance believable. No, it is that I didn't find their romance believable. No, it was fine.
Is this a multiple choice? Do you want me to edit one of those in? To based on how the conversation goes after this?
It wasn't the point of the movie, I guess. Mm. Like, where you were like, this is weird and I'm not really going to worry about it. Like, I don't think that it was really what we were supposed to be focusing on. Although I will say I did appreciate watching people who weren't 20 fall in love, you know, or express affection towards each other in, like, their very uncomfortable, awkward, like, I'm trying to protect myself, but also I want to love you, but also I feel so much pain, but also I think I want to love you. That was very relatable, both personally and, like, what I see other people going through when you're not, like, 18 and you actually know better about what can happen.
Anna, have you seen The Fisher King?
No, should I? I'll add it to the list.
I mean, yes. I'm gonna not even qualify this. Yes. It's okay. An extraordinary film, and it's about a man who, after going through the extraordinary trauma of having his wife die violently in front of him, collapses into a alternate personality where he believes that he is a version of Percival of the Grail myth. And that he's trying to find the Holy Grail so that he can restore order. And the person who he meets is, and this is, he's played by Robin Williams. The person that he meets is Jeff Bridges, the shock jock disc jockey that caused the gunman to go into the restaurant and kill Williams' wife.
Whoa, what?
And so he feels deeply responsible for trying to help this guy figure out a way to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the main threads in The Fisher King is Perry, or who is his version of Percival. Perry is starting to fall in love again and feels deeply guilty and conflicted because his insane personality hasn't registered the fact that he was once married. And the guilt of being able to move on when he hasn't actually dealt with the traumatic event is incredibly painful to him. And it's one of the more intense and heart-tugging scenes in the movie. And there's a scene where they need to break into a big castle, much like this one. In fact, I went and looked up to see if maybe it was the same building. It's not. But there are interesting parallels between Fisher King and this film. And I think that key one is that this is about a man who, because of trauma of the death of his wife, has retreated into an alternate reality to protect himself, is now finding a helpmate for the first time since the death of his wife. It's not really about that. You see a couple of tender moments with him in the flowers and... but he doesn't wrestle with it in the same way that Williams' character does in The Fisher King. It's not reopening old wounds. It's just the quiet sadness of moving on. But there was fascinating, interesting parallels.
Maybe part of the reason why I think that the relationship isn't at the center of this movie is because the movie ends in a way that is very open, very unresolved. And I didn't feel... personally, like it was leading to a conclusion where it was trying to say one thing or another. You know what I mean? Like when movies end like that, it's not like a, there's not a finality to it that,
well,
but
we don't normally, I mean, I want to talk to about the ending because as you say, it is open to a certain degree of interpretation. I don't think we've ever dealt with literally talking about the final shot of a movie before. There's anybody who's interested because
we
of listening
totally
to
talked
podcast
about Booster McCloud. Because that was like the best part of
that
movie.
Yeah, that's right, we did. All right. Then I think we can feel safe in saying we talk a lot. And so God only knows for how many minutes we're going to be spoiling this movie. You might just want to skip ahead to the quiz. But yeah, let's talk about this. Earlier, I posited the idea that one of the aspects of their relationship is that she's willing to buy into his reality, even if she doesn't completely see it. And one of the key aspects of that final scene, as they're standing in front of a tunnel in a park that's completely black, and Justin Holmes says, "Moriarty is there. Can't you hear the hoofbeats as he's riding towards us?" By the way, huge demonic knight figure in The Fisher King on horseback. It's all through. It's like the primary nemesis of Percival in that film. And so to have the illusory Moriarty also be coming, and Justin says, "Can you see him? Can you hear him?" And she says, "No." And then the soundtrack starts playing the hoofbeats, which then turn into a combination of hoofbeats and snare drums in a military cadence and the ticking of a clock in a strange combination where you're not quite sure what is marching towards them. Is it violence or nobility or inevitability? whatever you consider those things to represent, drums and hooves and clock gears. And then she says, I can hear it. Is she humoring him, or is she joining in his insanity?
A sound, please, just a little sound.
Stand up.
Holmesy's not there. There isn't any Moriarty, it's just...
You hear it?
And depending on the answer to that, what does it mean?
If you are actually asking me, I do not know. I got to the end and I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I could have seen that coming. And I like basically went back immediately to the beginning and started over.
Yeah, it's not really an ending.
No, I think that level of ambiguity was what I expected. You know, that we wouldn't really get a resolution for like whose reality comes out on top. But nor was it. I don't know. You know me. I'm always like, well, what is this movie trying to say?
Well, I said what I thought the movie was trying to say earlier, in part by saying what the director had wanted it to say and how he felt it was changed into what it was. So he seems to think that it's a movie about the relationship, but that wasn't what its intent was, which was my way of not answering that question. But you snapped back at that a little bit. You didn't seem to think that that was a good answer or the right answer. What do you think the movie is trying to say? Because that would help us, as you say, interpret the ending.
I think that this movie is about what we perceive of as, I'm trying to come up with the right language for it, like valid mental states, like valid states of consciousness. I think that for me, thinking about the context of this film, where the play came out in 61 and the movie came out in 71, where we had deinstitutionalization starting in the 50s in the United States. I'm not sure when it started in the UK, if like that context was different at all. But then you had the spread or the acceptance of psychedelics in the 60s. And I think that that has its own implications for altered states of consciousness.
And the acceptance thereof.
And the acceptance thereof, absolutely. And, I, you know, there's one scene where they're in the theater and Watson is like down on the floor looking for her shoe. She's looking under the theater seats and she pops her head up and she says this thing about mushrooms growing under the seats.
Grief, I think they're growing mushrooms.
It's kind of like quirky and out of place. And I was like, that is a joke for the like...
the druggy, correct.
Yeah, yeah. It really felt that way, especially like 71. It's hard to not assume that. So I think for me, I see this movie as being probably about a lot of things, as most movies are, right? But really about this underlying social awareness of respecting people that are, you know, at that time, like trying to reintegrate into the wider culture after being institutionalized, having a sense that, you know, really what the movie is illustrating, that like one person's experience doesn't necessarily take precedence over another, you know, like a doctor's experience and opinion and perspective isn't necessarily more superior or correct than another person's, like just because we've labeled them, you know, like mentally ill doesn't mean that their experience isn't valid or quote unquote true. And so I think that this movie sort of plays with a lot of that, and I don't think it necessarily gets it all right. But if I was left alone with this movie and had to like write an essay about it, that's what it would be about.
Yeah, the Time magazine review is particularly harsh about that aspect of it. They find that romanticization of other points of view are magical and helpful and we should give them a chance. They say is about 35 years old and wasn't very useful then, which is interesting to think about that it's taking place only a couple of years after Easy Rider and a year after the stuff that we talked about with Jack Nicholson and Bob Rafelson and those films that came out of that group. Those things were very much being popularized in one aspect, and yet somebody else is saying, aren't we better than this? Didn't we already dismiss this as not useful?
Okay, Time magazine. I don't know. And I...
Fair point. Fair point. The establishment.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, and I mean, I think that the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? Like, I mean, people are really suffering, and just accepting everybody's mental state as groovy isn't going to help people who really need help, and that is clear. You know, that some people really need a floor, like, slipped underneath them that they can get a purchase on, you know, they can stand on. But on the other end, treating everybody who's different as though they are a problem is also not working. And we know that. And just having this really rigid Western view of the psyche or consciousness is super boring. And we've known that for a long time. And I think both of those conversations are still going on 50 years later, which is, you know, such a bummer.
Well, as somebody who personally feels that we're never going to be able to classify, quantify, or be able to successfully scientifically deconstruct consciousness, I think that therefore we're never going to stop having this conversation.
No, and I think not to, like, classify it per se, but to, oh, I don't know, maybe do a little bit more around respecting people who are having a, like, a different experience than, like, a very, like, specific, rigid, narrow definition of, like, what is healthy or, like, what is okay. You know, like, if you hear voices and you talk to them and you see visions, like,
and they're not hurtful.
And it's not hurtful. I think that there's, like, I think that wasn't explored enough in this movie, is that, like, where symptoms are maladaptive and they're really harmful to your day-to-day life, that is really where intervention can be helpful. You know, like, I am not a mental health expert. I am not a provider of anything, and no one should listen to me at all. So, but
but now that you're not listening, let me tell you what you need to know.
No, I mean, just in case anyone, like, misinterprets, like, the things that I'm saying as, like, being educated in any way, I am not. But
I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me is my co-host Anna, mental health expert.
This is, like, a great thing to get us back around to the movie, where I don't remember the Time article, but maybe part of what they're saying is, like, it presents this, like, really quirky view of, like, oh, isn't this fun and great? And it showed nothing of, like, the real suffering that people go through, where, like, when people need help, like, and you don't have an answer for that, you can't just be like, oh, everyone's state of consciousness is fine just the way that they are. Like, that's not realistic either.
Well said. I was just going to say, I think what the film is about is finding somebody else who can appreciate whatever your take on what the world is and your place in it. That the march is about people finding each other, and that it's all the people who have discovered that there's somebody else out there that sees that the world is more than what the system thinks it is. One of the people that particularly draws that into relief is Justin's brother's wife, played by Rue McClanahan, most famous probably for being one quarter of the Gilmore Girls, of the Golden Girls, who says,
"Oh, this fun! I'm leaving Blevin.
I'm glad to hear it.
I married him for love, and I don't love him anymore.
We're meeting Moriarty.
Hot dog."
That she was with somebody who their take on the world was in sync. And then it's not. So now she's thrown her lot in with this merry band of misfits finding each other. And instantly is welcomed in to say, great, if you see the world like us, then be with us. And almost everybody sort of pairs off. You have the girl and her musician who was now saved. You've got the telephone operator. You've got the two waste disposal guys, like the nurse and Rudy Valentino. You've got that sense of everybody's finding the person that says, oh, you get me. And as long as none of what they're doing is harmful, finding another person that does see the world through your type of lenses is what provides you with something that makes you feel like this is going to be okay. Which then ultimately does bring us back to the question of, does Mildred Watson see Moriarty, or is she just trying in order to make him feel better. That kind of ambiguity would make this film either she's willing to live a lie in order to help him, or they are actually in sync. Is that a tragedy or is that a victory? Would depend on lots of different perspectives on whether you think that their altered states, their off-sync takes on what is real, is safe or healthy or not.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we lost her character a little bit along the way. And I think that was purposeful to sort of like upset the balance of like who they are at the start. You know, that we sort of like see her losing the grip, you know, a little bit. But I think
especially... much in the way in which he destabilizes her with his expert Sherlock Holmes analysis in order to get her to maybe trust him a little bit. Similarly, she's broken down in terms of saying, well, society works, we'll get these things to work, the system is on our side. She goes through a rush of experiences in order to say, oh, wait, actually, none of this works, in order for her to be destabilized enough in order to, as you were saying.
Yeah, for the plot device of them sort of like switching places in the like the power structure of the cultural milieu. Is that how I want to say that? I don't know. You know what I mean, though.
I knew exactly what you meant. And you, well, the way you say it is better than my terribly affected French
version. Let's hear it. Let's spit it out, Quinn.
Milieu.
Yeah. I actually think your way is better. I think because there was a gender component, that was part of the reason why I sort of lost the thread with her character. Instead of it feeling solid and sensible, it sort of just seemed like she was an increasingly frantic and overwhelmed, you know, a hysterical lady.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard not to have that cultural weight.
Mm-hmm. So it muddied it a little bit for me. But I think if we can extract that a little bit, the core essence of what I think they were trying to do did work. But it does still leave the question of, was she there with him genuinely? I think so. I think if we think about how she was changing as a character, like, yeah, I think so.
Would this have worked better for you if Dr. Watson was a traditional Dr. James Watson? And he had been broken down from his establishment roots as a psychiatrist and professional to believing and trusting this insane man?
If they had both been men?
Yeah.
I think that would be like a super fun reboot of this movie. Yeah, I would definitely watch that.
I think what you're saying about the weight of the hysterical aspect of her becoming unfettered and her hair mussed up and losing a shoe, and like those are all weak lady tropes.
Mm-hmm.
And if for a man to do that, to be broken down by his insight and his... and Holmes's exposure of him to this insane alternate world, and to have him then place his trust in Holmes, it would be less of a weakness and more of a discovery, less of an inherent gender flaw and a power dynamic, as opposed to just the power dynamic of he actually knows best.
Yeah, I think it would be a much clearer journey for sure, instead of it reading like, oh, like it's just this like lonely heart psychiatrist who has been longing for a man. And she has been so desperate to be negged this whole time. She just falls for the first patient who is clever enough to really read her. I think that there is some of that that feels a little repellent with the gender dynamics, but I think it could play really well with that removed. But I don't know, I'm like rethinking that as I'm saying it. I'm like, maybe it's just because like I'm so caught up on gender, and if I just learned to not see it, then...
But we do see the world through those lenses, which means you aren't going to be the only person who finds that this movie is creaking under that weight.
Yeah, I think that the cultural context is relevant.
And yeah, that's one of the things about culture, is that it's part of the atmosphere that we all experience. And so if that would be a thing that would prevent the studio from re-editing this picture into being a romance, and kept what the director said was the excitement of the madness, then that clearly maybe should have been better without it. That Goldman's conceit of hiding the fact that she was Dr. Watson for the first 20 minutes.
Listen, my name is Watson, Mildred Watson. I'm a doctor. I'm not beautiful or rich or ambitious, and about the only thing I care about in life is to cure.
And then having that be the revelation that gets Justin to instantly transfer his trust onto her.
There she is, my chronicler and good right arm. Frankly, I am a little disappointed, but if anyone can make a detective out of you, I'm the man. Let's go.
Because the doctor is a woman. A very 70s trope.
They did it twice, right?
Where else?
Well, they did it in the scene where she's with Mr. Little.
Mm-hmm. Where they think she's the patient.
And then I guess they did it again when she's with
Justin. Yeah, you're very right. They do it twice in the same movie. Yeah, the first being that instead of her being the crazy hysterical woman, she's the expert. And then the secret that she's been Dr. Watson the whole time is finally revealed.
So, okay, so there's this thing where once upon a time, it was so common to have hysterical female characters that, you know, like, it gets an eye roll and it's, like, very annoying. Then we move into an era where, like, all you have is, like, strong female characters. And that's annoying.
That they can show no weakness whatsoever because that detracts from the attempt of making sure that everybody is equal.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that there's, like, a transcendence, which is, like, Bridesmaids to me. Mm. I know people feel, like, really mixed about that movie. But, you know, we're, like, people just get to be people eventually. And I think that's how I wish I could see this movie, is just, like, that this character is just a person and removed even from the context of its time or how it's written.
If this were remade and you hadn't been aware that it was a remake or that it had been a play in 1961, this was released in 2020, sans context, do you feel like, because we post-Bridesmaids live in a world where...
I'm going to really regret saying that out loud, having that on the internet forever.
Nope, I'm running with it. I'm running with it unironically. That therefore she could just be a character who is flawed for her flaws and strong for her strengths without it being representative of the whole sex. Is the 70s of it the thing that gets you to feel like it has that additional cultural?
Yeah, probably, because I'm sure that it would be written completely different. You know, like that the choices that people would make now would be different. You know, maybe they would have, like, a guy in her role, or, you know, somebody who's non-binary, or just be like just exploring those themes in a way that is more relevant to our current context. And if they did have somebody who was a woman in that character, I think that they wouldn't write it the same way. Or, you know, maybe they would. I don't really watch a ton of movies nowadays. I don't know. I don't know what kind of trash they're turning out. But but I think some of the stuff I'm responding to is, like, you live alone. You drink yourself to sleep. You, no one has ever loved you. You're married to your job. You know, just like these, it's just so tropey. Like, it is.
It gets stacked, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then she's, like, fawning all over this person who is just, he's cool, but there's no reason for her to. And I mean, I think this, like, comes up in one of the reviews about the movie, is, like, there's literally no reason for her to feel love for him. You know, like, they do not know each other. And she is in, like, unethical gaga love with him. Like,
yeah, I was, in addition to the pass on, she goes from his doctor to being a nervous schoolgirl around him over the course of about 6 hours. And I was just letting that happen without deeply interrogating it. I was also not at all investigating the total ethical lapse of a doctor having a relationship with their patients. I was just being like, all right, old movie.
Yeah, totally. I think with some of these, it's so much to address. Like, if we were going to start, you know, picking apart, like, all of the things that were problematic, like, we could not ever get to the plot.
But it is worth saying. It is worth saying that we allowed this movie, I can't speak for you. Maybe you'll agree with me or not. I allowed this movie to have big old blind spots because I was interested in addressing what I thought it wanted to talk about. I was interested in having its conversation with its themes and not poking at all the problems of its presentation by saying, let's pay attention to the fact that this is majorly problematic and this is so that I couldn't even talk about what the movie is ostensibly about in the first place. But it is important to say that none of those things hold up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different to put up blinders in order to talk about it and to give it a pass,
mm-hmm.
I think is my point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that a lot of these movies that we watch from this era, like even going back to MASH, I remember was like really problematic. And I was like, yeah, you know what? It's fine though, because they're just like pranksters and it was like a different time. I don't even know what nonsense I said.
I'm going to say, if my memory serves, you were like, they're cute, therefore they get a pass.
I was like, they're so cool. No, they were monsters and they did bad things. I just want to set the record.
You've already reset that record, but in case somebody missed that episode, congratulations on doing it.
I think that this is like an ongoing issue though with these with these movies from this era, is that like watching movies in general where there's like the willful suspension of disbelief, that there's like a lot that you have to sort of like pick up and set aside if you want to be able to engage with the movie at all. I think that's what you're saying. And I think that probably we should do an episode where we revisit like all the movies that we watch and just give like a rundown in like every category we can think of. There's been problematic stuff that we haven't covered, because I really do feel like, well, I strongly feel like I am not super well versed in order to like cover topics adequately, but it's not my podcast. We're not here to talk about how problematic these movies were, you know.
when we do our eventual spin-off Golden Anniversaries, where we talk about 50-year-old dramas and westerns and we talk about how much you love them and then we talk about how problematic they are, we will definitely do all of that.
Can you separate the art from the artist? We never did that Woody Allen movie. That was a hard no.
For listeners who haven't been paying attention to the timeline, Woody Allen's film Bananas came out a couple weeks ago, 50 years ago, on the 26th of May, 1971. Bananas enters into the box office charts at number 6. It drops to 7, and then this week that this came out on June 9th, it's the number 3 most successful movie in America, and continues to be in the top 10 for a couple more weeks before finally disappearing at the end of June. And of course, it's generally considered to be one of the massively successful, quote, early funny Woody Allens, unquote. But it was one of the ones that helped launch his career, that led to Sleeper and the ones that people think are his masterworks. And yeah, this movie is nowhere in the top 10. Bananas is running with it right about now, along with Walter Matthau's Plaza Suite, and Love Story with Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neal, and a couple of other interesting things. We have Sweet Sweeback's Badass Song by Melvin Van Peebles, and in a couple of weeks we'll have Shaft also taking the box office by score.
Is that a comedy?
No. Which is why we aren't necessarily reviewing them. But that's one of the interesting questions. You have been saying, I'm kind of sick of 70s humor. Let's spread our wings and look at other things. The other things are the ones that have sometimes more cultural relevance because they are the masses' successes that are being talked about at the time. but they're just not necessarily funny. But yes, we chose to because we decided we didn't want to have to address these several elephants, the menagerie of problems in the room that come with talking about a Woody Allen movie, to nimbly skip over that and just move on to something else.
Yeah, I think even this is probably giving him more airtime than I want to. But
yeah, this may not make it into the episode. But your point is that if the point of this podcast is asking what holds up, sometimes we're saying what jokes hold up. Sometimes we're saying what concepts, what cultural conceits on which the movie is based hold up.
Yeah, and I think that there's different rulers to use when you're asking, like, what holds up. Like, how harsh do you want to be? Like, if you want to be Portland harsh, you're going to be Portland Gen Z harsh. None of this holds up. It just does not. Like, but if you want to be like East Coast, like, cinema connoisseur harsh, then like, you know, I think that you can find stuff in these movies that's really interesting and valuable.
Again, I'm feeling very deconstructed by you in this episode.
Sorry.
Nope, just point it out. You've got a mean, and by mean I say not cruel, but effective, a psychic scalpel going on at the moment. We watch a movie about female psychiatrists and the knives are out.
Maybe I should switch professions.
Well, on that note, let's move on to the minute and the quiz that is our turning point. So then we can focus less on the big picture context of the movie and end out by talking about five things that were allowed to be interesting or okay, regardless of the larger cultural issues. And in order to get there, we have to put you through the ringer of having you watch a minute from the film and then answering five quiz questions about it.
Okay.
We have no idea what their morality is. People at random.org have provided us with, out of the 91 minutes of this film, minute number 33.
Okay.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Well, we missed lunch. You really ought to have something.
I'm an adult. I can feed myself, all right?
Oh, sorry, no offense.
Just watch the movie, all right?
All right, Anna, are you ready?
No. It kept messing up. I was able to hear the audio, but the video kept messing up, which is why it took me a little bit longer than a minute.
Do you want to watch it intacto again, or you feel good?
No, I think it's okay.
All right. You have 30 seconds to summarize this minute.
Okay.
And your 30 seconds begins now.
Okay. Sherlock is like, hey, why don't you eat something? And Watson is like, don't tell me what to do. I ate before. And then Sherlock is like, hey, you can't see anything without your glasses. And she's like really ornery again. And then she's like, I wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for you, because the police are chasing us.
10 seconds left.
And then Sherlock is like, you know, I really enjoy spending time with you, but you should smile more.
5 seconds left.
It was very tender until he said that, and it's a very typical, like, hilariously.
Time! Congratulations, you got it all in.
Okay.
Because, yes, that scene does end on him saying, you should smile more. A thing that has very much come up into public consciousness recently, of a thing that men ask women to do, and which leapt out at me as a very strange thing, particularly because she does sort of quietly, privately smile to herself, not with her teeth, not a big beaming, you know, where she's a Crest advert, but sort of quietly to herself is pleased that he finds her attractive at all. I did seriously consider writing a quiz based entirely on the current social compact of women telling men, stop asking me to smile, you
idiot.
And I also considered delving into the history of those particularly fabulous garish glasses that she wears.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, we are going to talk about the snack that Justin provides her. We're going to have five questions about Juji fruits. Question number one. Juju fruits are the specific brand name of a kind of candy called a jujube. Jujubes were called this because A. The original 18th century recipe required the jujube fruit, which is also referred to as the Chinese date, for flavoring. B. They were developed from West African folk recipes passed down by American enslaved persons. And magic in West African cultures is referred to as juju. Or C. The name is a slang bastardization of chewy cherubs, which became chew babies and then jujubes between 1750 and 1920 in Louisiana.
C.
No, unfortunately, it is the jujube fruit. Oh, it's that simple.
Oh, I was going to pick that one. I should have gone with it.
Question number two. Jujube fruits were, unsurprisingly, mostly fruit-flavored. However, what shapes did the sweets come in? A. Bees, beetles, and, bizarrely, fish. B. Vegetables, including pea pods, tomatoes, and asparagus. Or C. A combination of textured fruits, pineapples and raspberries, and geodesic forms, spheres, dodecahedrons, and square pyramids.
A.
Unfortunately, the bees in jujubes has nothing to do with bees. Weirdly enough, the fruit-flavored snacks are shaped like vegetables. Question number three. Jujube fruits were first manufactured by the Ferrara Company in 1920. At that time, the green was not fruit-flavored, but was mint-flavored. This was changed when Ferrara was a subsidy of Hershey's. But when was it changed? A. 1941. B. 1955. C. 1971. D. 1984. Or E. 1999.
F? No G? H?
I have been trying to keep these down to three options because I do think, mathematically speaking, it's just a little bit harder than flipping a coin, but I have two five questions in this quiz because I couldn't help myself.
A.
So you're saying that you think they changed it from mint right around World War II?
Yes.
No, unfortunately, it was the latest. It was mint amongst the fruits all the way until 1999.
Well, that is definitely the last one I would have picked, so I don't feel bad.
Question number four. What other candies were manufactured by the Ferrara Candy Company? A. Boston Baked Beans. B. Fruit Stripe Gum. C. Lemon Heads. D. All of the above. E. None of the above.
A.
It was all of the above. But I like that you went for the Boston Baked Beans. Do you remember that there was a candy called Boston Baked Beans?
Yeah.
I totally forgot that was the thing. Final question. The Wikipedia entry on jujube fruits is very slim, but contains two pop culture references, where they think that it's important for people to know that jujube fruits are referred to in these pop cultural icons. So which of these three, therefore, is not on Wikipedia? A. That during the 1970s, one could send a proof of purchase in $5 and receive a branded jujube fruit cowboy belt buckle. B. That the Belle character in the YA update of Beauty and the Beast, Beastly, starring Vanessa Hudgens, has a, quote, penchant for jujube fruits. Or C, this scene from this movie and the source play.
C.
Correct.
Got one.
Nowhere on Wikipedia does anybody care that jujube fruits come up in They Might Be Giants.
You could add it.
Perhaps by the time this episode comes out, this question will be wrong. And you'll be retroactively subtracted. Unfortunately, that means that you only got one question correct out of the five, plus the additional bonus point of having blazingly been successful at this 30-second summary, which is not enough points to go on to claim victory in this round. But considering that you've won twice, which is supposed to give you the advantage of you writing the trivia for me, and you still haven't done it.
Maybe this will motivate me. It's easier for you because you're an educator.
What does that mean? Writing quizzes is easy for me?
It means that I'm going to write a quiz that is easy for you to figure out, and you're going to win, and I'm going to be mad.
Well, we live in the precarious Schrodinger's position of having no idea if that's true or not until you actually do it.
This way I can lose. Losing makes me less mad than writing a quiz where you win easily.
Where I blow through your paper questions like a cannonball.
Yeah. I can definitely see that happening.
Or you would be a thought process that's so foreign to my own, I would have no idea as to what is correct and what is fanciful.
I like that. Or maybe I'll just make them like very vicious personal questions, like, well, we'll see.
You'll just expose all my secrets through trivia. And I refuse to answer them on mic and therefore lose by default.
Yeah, it'll be multiple choice, but about like your preferences and hopes and dreams. And
you're just going to turn it into a Zanga quiz.
Yeah, I think that would be good.
Your definition of good is very strange, Dr. Withington.
Who are these quizzes good for, you know?
I hope they're fun to play along with at home.
Yeah, I hope that for people too. I hope it's good for somebody.
since it's apparently not doing very much for you. Well, let us move nimbly on to our final segment of the podcast, where we talk about our five favorite moments. A moment to refresh the memory of anybody who has stumbled into the middle of our series because they really want to listen to an episode about They Might Be Giants is not an entire scene, but a piece of acting or dialogue or performance or something that just made us stop or smile or think, a tiny gem that we wanted to preserve. Anna, what's one of your five favorite moments from the film?
I would say my top one is when we are introduced to Dr. Watson. Mm. And the scene opens with her laying on the couch talking to Mr. Little. And I missed it on the first watch because I knew who her character was beforehand. Mm. But I think that the way that the scene is set up, we're supposed to perceive her to be the patient in the scene. And she's, you know, talking about a dream, about a spider. And as the scene unfolds, we realize that she's the doctor.
He's coming.
Doctor. Mildred.
Now, is that what your dream was like?
Mildred.
Dr. Strauss, I am with a patient.
And the second time watching it, I was like, I see what they did there, you know, and sort of like what you were saying about like, oh, yeah, a lady doctor. Ooh. But I actually thought that it was really fun and also set sort of like an early stage for this thing that they do in the whole movie where they're sort of playing with the different relationships and like whose reality is whose or accepted.
Nice. Mm-hmm. I will say for my number two moment, there are lots of aspects of the telephone operator scene where they bust into the telephone company because it has an address that matches up with their fanciful ways of finding clues throughout the city. And they very much destroy the harmony of these women telephone operators hiding in the information booth and dispensing not very useful information to the calling public. And there's some confusion, and as they rush out of there, the security officer of the phone company says,
"They got guns, call the cops."
Right. What's their number?
And she says on the phone, "I can't call information. I am information." And it's one of the few characters in the movie who is presented just as a punchline with no sympathy underneath. She is a product of the machine and is so much a product that she is not given a chance to be redeemed.
Did they have 911 back then?
Fair point. What do you got for number three?
It's less of a specific moment and more of like a general love of a... Okay, so maybe you can help me out with the distinction between a caper and a farce. Mm. I felt I just connected with the word caper while I was watching this movie. I think because it's got like sort of like a mystery element. You know, they're trying to find Moriarty. So I use that word. But farce also felt kind of apt, you know, like mistaken identities and sort of like upstairs, downstairs, slamming doors, like running across rooftops, you know, like firing guns in the air, like getting into taxis, driving across town. I think like the caper slash farce energy is really fun. And yeah, anytime like two doors open back to back and there's like some kind of like... I don't think that happened specifically in this movie, but that was like the...
No, but we did have Holmes trying to escape out of the secret arboretum school, and he throws open the door, and there are two thugs right behind him. He's like, oops, not going to go that way. I mean, it was very much a cartoon there for
yeah,
a second.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. What is the difference between a caper and a farce?
I don't know. You started by using the word caper, and I was entranced with it.
Yeah.
In part because it made me feel like you thought that this was a fun film and therefore a successful film.
Mm.
And in the course of our conversation, I feel like we've both basically revealed that there were lots of problems with this movie, but we sort of waved them aside and tried not to pay attention. Did you think that this movie was ultimately successful, or did you just think that it was fun without being good?
I think it depends on what you think is successful. Like, it made me think. I found it to be challenging. It helped me reflect on things, and it expanded my knowledge. So in those ways, I felt like it was a successful movie. And in other ways, I found it to be unbelievable. And, you know, like, the characters, like, didn't necessarily make sense together. You know, like, not just the two main characters, but, like, all together. You know, like, the cast as a set, you know. Death by Quirk.
Quirk is a real killer for a lot of people. If something seems like it's just wacky in order to be like, whoa, hey! that's a death knell for a lot of folks. There has to be a groundedness for your surreality.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's interesting that it sort of like brings up this stuff about Justin and his wife's death at the beginning. Mm. And it introduces the question in the sort of like Chekhov's gun sort of way of like, oh, is he just suppressing his trauma? Mm-hmm. And then it never really returns to that. And it's like, what the hell, man? Like, is this gun going to go off or what? And instead it just like sort of layers on, not to use like too many like psychology terms, but it like sort of dissociates and gets quirkier and quirkier and never really gets to a real place where we're like, does anyone have to work actually? Like, I mean, I guess the psychiatrist actually does lose her job, you know, like she quits her job, but like there's no consequences. There's no like tethering or grounding. Like it just like continues to elevate itself away from any kind of
consequences.
Those realistic moments where like at the beginning, like the brother has this ransom note and like there's this, mm-hmm. you know, mean guy in a car with sunglasses riding around and you know.
Yeah, that's kind of a dropped thread.
Yeah, and there's like a dead wife that we're ignoring, you know, and trying to escape from. And none of that is, you know, we just sort of shove that all aside. And so I think, you know, is it successful? I don't know. What happened to all that other stuff? You know, but maybe that wasn't the point. I don't know. What is success?
Well, while ignoring your what's a caper question, I'm going to take what you just said and use it as a segue into one of my favorite moments, which was the character of Wilbur Peabody, the archivist that they go to visit in the castle.
Mm-hmm.
He has several wonderful moments, and I think he's the character that most successfully frames the film in terms of that mix of realism and fantasy, where he talks about how he envies Justin as Holmes because he had always wanted to be the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Mm.
And he had wanted to have a dual identity and to be a character out of fiction.
Is he in heaven? Is he in hell? That damned elusive Pimpernel. What's that? You want to see the face behind the mask? This is the face.
But instead, he's just an old man in a basement processing files. And what this film gives him, what the circumstances and the community of strange strangers that emerges gives him, is the opportunity to be the Scarlet Pimpernel for a moment. That, I think, is ultimately one of the things the film wants to have, is the somewhat specious idea that insanity can be liberating and transformative. But Wilbur is the most successful vehicle for that, where he is a heartfelt person who's able to talk to Justin and connect with him as a person he used to be and the person he is now without really needing to fix him, and yet who also wishes that he'd had his own magical experience that made him in a super real state as well, I think is a fantasy that a lot of people could connect to. And that is therefore a nice beating heart in the center of this movie.
Interesting.
But he also has no consequences. He gets to live out his fantasy. He gets to, you know, have a fake sword and slash at some cops and then almost get arrested and then run away. But because none of the rest of the crazy gang, to use a phrase that would definitely be triggering in the way which we talked about in the beginning of the episode,
I think it's okay.
None of the rest of our found family is able to. We have no idea what happens to any of them. They just duck out the back of the supermarket and are no longer part of the story. And so that is very much a consequence-free aspect to all of those characters. What did they get out of this? We hope that he feels something for having lived this moment. Is that a place we want him to stay? Probably not. Probably we want him to have had it as a gem, as a moment that allows him to feel better about his own circumstances.
Yeah, I thought his character was interesting. I'd actually like to rewatch some of those scenes with him again, because I think that was actually a pretty rich set of scenes with him.
It helps that he's a quietly dignified actor in the middle of the film, that he's not showy, he's not doing a lot of business, he's just sort of gentle and old and sympathetic, played by the actor Jack Gilford, who I believe is third credited in the film. I think they really thought that he was important.
Interesting.
And was sort of well known apparently as a comedian, was friends with Zero Mostel and had been in A Funny Thing Happens on the Way to the Forum, which is definitely farce.
You need to make this distinction. I can't wait to look that up later. Put it in the show notes.
One of the reasons I'm avoiding it is, to me, I have a hard time disentangling caper from heist.
Oh, well, a heist is not funny. I mean, it can be, but like a caper implies hilarity.
But I think it has to be an action-y thing in the way that a heist is an action-y thing, where there's a goal and a thing that you're trying to achieve.
Well, they're trying to find Moriarty.
But we're also told that what Moriarty is the unfairness of death. Like, Moriarty is everything that Justin is unable to control. Moriarty is the narrative of, how could this terrible, unfair thing happen to Justin? Therefore, Holmes turns him into Moriarty, turns the unfairness, existentialness of life into a personification so that he has somebody to defeat, which he can't do because you can't defeat the unfairness of being alive.
Is that what Watson says about it? Or is that what Holmes says about it?
Or is that what I say about it? I can no longer tell you. I think it's talked about by the brother when Holmes is hiding in the closet in the study.
He's the greatest enemy a man could have. He's everywhere. Look. Girl scout killed crossing street. Grandmother raped and beaten.
Because that's where we get the idea. That's where we get told that his wife died suddenly. And then he started hunting for Moriarty. I think that's where we're meant to make the obvious connection that Moriarty is a stand-in for he can't deal with the fact that things just happen.
Mm-hmm.
Orphanage in flames, five die. Excursion boat explodes. Who does these things? Who is responsible?
Well, there might be accidents.
I don't believe in accidents.
Well, I guess we don't really know who Moriarty is then, or what Moriarty is.
But if that were true, if that's the definition of a caper, that it's a humorous, adventurous way to reach a goal, we know that he doesn't defeat Moriarty. Is a caper where you lose still a caper?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you have a goal and you have all these steps to reach the goal. I mean, think about all of the clues.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually brings me to number 5, which is not a thing that I like. It's actually a thing that I don't like.
So -1.
Which is,
yeah, you implied this earlier.
Yeah, which is all of the ways that these very, you know, so-called clues are taken from, you know, the ether, sort of like things that are happening around them, or like, mm-hmm. like 20 grand is on the ransom note, and that becomes like one of the first clues. And it's like, oh, like, what does this mean? Is this an address?
What do you think?
It's the telephone company.
Just the place he'd leave a message for me.
And having been around people who are in acute psychotic states and expressing this kind of association, sort of like free association, but also like intense meaning placed on like very insignificant things, I find it perhaps personally troubling, but also it's just annoying. Especially like the smarter the person is, the more persuasive it can be, where you're like, I guess maybe. I think most of the ones in the movie were not particularly persuasive. They were just sort of this free association, like wordplay kind of thing. But I find it very draining, even on screen.
On the Colbert Report, he used to do a segment based on the success of the Da Vinci Code called the Colbert Code. His whole bit was is that he would free associate words with each other that would lead him from the question to the answer, much in the way that Dan Brown doesn't have any real storytelling and would just get to the conclusion he wanted with a series of trails that don't make any sense in the middle.
Savage.
Yeah, take that, Dan Brown. Your multi-million-dollar success and your forthcoming adaptation of The Lost Symbol, and we have 20 people listening to this podcast. I'm really taking you down. Anyway, I found it incredibly funny, and whenever it happened on the show, I was there for it. But I think that if I had had intense personal experiences with people projecting meaning onto things in a way that left them convinced about the secret signs and symbols of the world, I would be less able to laugh at it.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it is just because it's personal. But I will say, you know, a lot of people experience psychosis, and it's not always dramatic. And I think it's common enough, and it overlaps enough with symptoms of anxiety and severe depression and things like that, that people feel a lot of discomfort if they experience it sometimes. But it's super normal. I think it's, you know, like we were talking about before, like the more distress it causes and the more interferes with like the other thing you want to do in your life, like if it's keeping you back. But I think that's, you know, again, sort of the theme that we're touching on is like, who gets to decide? And I think like,
what's okay?
And yeah.
What is helpful and what is harmful?
Yeah. Especially when once you start running into like, you know, mysticism and spirituality and people who are more in tune with other ways of seeing, it really becomes a lot blurrier. And I know you're a confirmed atheist, Ben, so you're not into all that hogwash. I actually don't know if that's true. Just hurling accusations at you.
Well, I went to my atheist church and I had my confirmation ceremony, so yes, I am a confirmed atheist.
They baptize you too?
Yeah, with unholy water. They take Avion and they do it in the symbol of the dodecahedron.
Yeah, so nothing I said just now made any sense to you. I get it, but... For everyone on the West Coast.
Who's got way too much exposure to sunlight and is therefore pumped full of an unhealthy amount of endorphins, and therefore is operating at a higher frequency and therefore liable to accept garbage as truth.
Come on over.
It's my only conspiracy theory.
Yeah, we'll put some resources in the show notes. I'm sorry, I'm very... Somebody... over the weekend I went camping and somebody used that phrase a lot, like, oh, well, we'll put it in the show notes, like whenever there was something we were talking about that we didn't want to look up or we couldn't look up because we were at a cell service.
I
thought
it
was hilarious. But now we actually are on a show and there will be show notes.
And there's no we writing these show notes.
I'll write it up. But I feel like it's less funny because it's literal. It's different.
And, well, do you want to end this podcast on if these concepts and criticisms affected you, please make sure that you don't sit there in your distress, but that you reach out to somebody that would be helpful.
Yeah. I think
Do that thing, listeners, because I am not qualified to be helpful, and I'm sure I've used language that was aggressive and alienating instead of embracing and helpful and kind.
We'll put some resources in the show notes.
First Perspective was created and developed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. This episode was researched, recorded, and produced by the presenters. Editing by Ben Russell. The logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song was mixed from recordings of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, sourced from clips on archive.org, which we believe are either in the Creative Commons or altered enough for creative fair use. All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. You can find us at farceperspective.com, and we're also on Blue Sky under the username farceperspective.com. If there are things, facts, or data of any kind you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we will post it to our errata page on Farce Perspective as soon as possible. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, and our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest in contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben, my co-host is Anna, and we'll see you next time when we consider another comic touchstone celebrating a key anniversary.